get it.
This is the 23rd of March, 1987, the regularly scheduled meeting of the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources.
All right, we'll make an appointment.
Senate Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee will come to order. Clerk will note the members present. The others are excused. I want to announce at the outset that we're not going to be having a hearing or possible work session on 969 or SJR 24 at the present time. We're going to deal basically with Senate Bill 122 and the rather massive amendments that have been proposed to Senate Bill 122. Mr. Hansen, why don't you come forward? And why don't we have Tom Novick and Tom Donica up here with you?
I need some of my staff.
Oh, okay. Have them come up first. That's fine. We'll wait for the. We'll wait to hear from the other people.
Okay. Well, if we thought we'd do, Mr. Chairman, it would be all right by you, is to walk through the bill itself, to substantively what it does, which is where all the agreement is. You need to hear from other people, and then to get into the two issues that are yet outstanding.
Yeah, that's fine. We definitely need to understand. Now, when you say walk through the bill, I assume you're talking about the amendments. Yeah.
Well, let's. I got to make sure what you have.
Yes, well, we have the amendments, the 50-page amendments that I think are the result of. Is that dash two?
From Ledge Council.
Right, yeah. Legislative Council 122-2. Is that what it is?
That's what you did.
Okay, that's what we all have.
Okay.
So maybe other members of the public would be interested in having those, and they're available to you if you want to get them right here.
Yeah, Kurt, you come on up. So, Chairman, what we're doing is we're really going through the bill. I'm not trying to talk about every section, but really trying to be able to focus on those issues that are the significant points. And it means that some sections we're going to spend more time on, others we'll just kind of briefly go through.
That's fine.
One apology, and that is that we did not get the bill with the from LC until this morning. And so my notes are off of the Friday bill, which means that they're slightly different pages. What we're going to have to do is we're going to have to, you'll want to say, hold on, where's that section? Somebody's going to have to fill in for that for me, because I don't have that on my marked version.
Okay.
In terms of the definitions, several I point to, I think maybe first is owner-operator, which is on page three. What we are talking about is the key piece there is that, again, it's anybody who has owned, leased, operated, controlled, or exercised any significant control over. The term does not include a person who basically has a security interest in the facility. So again, what we're trying to do is make sure that and this will become significant when we get into the liability issues, but again, important.
Mr. Chairman, what Senator Kintyre, what line are we on here? On three?
Page three?
Line six.
6 through 11.
Let me make sure I understand that. It's not clear a person who, without participating in the management of a facility, what is an indicia of ownership? Is that a deed or a security interest or something?
Kurt Burkholder, who is the Assistant Attorney General who's been working on this, is here to be able to deal with some of the legal aspects, so I will let Kurt describe specifically.
Senator, members of the committee, that would be your usual example of when this would be triggered. A bank holding a contract or a mortgage on a piece of property, that is an indicia of title until title passes. They would not be considered an owner if that's the only reason they have that indicia of title and they're not exercising control over the facility.
Okay. Fine. Thank you.
Going on, Mr. Chairman, again, providing really parallels to some of the language we have in other places, but hazardous substances, maybe any substance also beyond just the CERCLA of the federal list, and oil, any substance designated by the commission that has authority that is in other statutes. Also, it is here that would be covered by this. Again, under release, definition and release, which is on page three also, beginning on page three, talks about the normal definition of what's spill and so on. The important part is it'll appear on page four, and that is the accept, and those are solely within a workplace, from emissions from exhaust and so on. Again, all I want to do is point that out, that it is not any kind of emission or any kind of release. There are exemptions here that are important.
Fred, did you have to go to the thesaurus to develop this definition, or what?
This is actually pretty much the federal definition. And again, what we tried to be able to do, by the way, throughout this, and I should stress this, that we tried to be able to make as often as we could absolute parallel language to the federal program so there would not be the conflicts where people would say, hold it, the state used one set of words and the feds used another, did they mean different things? So that we tried to be able to pull out parallel. And in fact, Mr. Chairman, that's part of the reason why it's a little bit laborious in our going through that. We'd rather not
have to
have
all that. I just kind of enjoy it, that's all. It's really quite the definition.
Okay. The remedy and remedial actions, again, just a brief comment on the definition. It's an all-encompassing one, again, parallel to federal, but it really takes care of every kind of conceivable action that you can think of, and again, parallel to the federal law.
Okay.
Remedial action costs. Page 5, line 17, indicate that it's the normal cost associated with it, with certain levels of health studies. This is an issue that you may hear more about. I do want to highlight that that is where it appears here. That is health studies included in that remedial action cost. So much for the definitions. What I'd like to do is turn to section 4.
Page 7.
Okay.
Again, clear statement that we may participate, the Department of Environmental Quality may participate in all actions relating to the Federal Superfund cleanup program. Section 5, we talk about the commission may adopt rules to be able to carry this out. Now, let me indicate that they may adopt rules to carry out any provision of the Act. There are, however, again, Section 5, page 8, that we are, in fact, required to adopt certain rules. The commission, this is on subsection 2A, the commission shall adopt rules within 1 year regarding levels, factors, and criteria or other provisions for the degree of cleanup. That is, how clean is clean, the ability to be able to identify that. And again, that's a must, that we must develop such rules. And secondly, that we must deal with the criteria for the selection of the remedial action that will be utilized. So, general rulemaking authority, but in two areas the commission must adopt rules, and it's in these two areas, degree of cleanup and selection of the remedial action. Trying to be able to make sure that all those people who are interested have the full abilities of the APA process to be able to influence and comment upon those criteria, those rules.
Mr. Chairman?
I guess I don't, describe to me what a rule dealing with those issues would say. I mean, how are you going to describe in advance what constitutes clean or cleaned up?
Al, why don't you outline a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one example would be to define a process that a party goes through.
You need to identify yourself for the record.
Al Goodman, manager at DEQ Remedial Action Section. One alternative that EPA has used at the federal level in addressing how clean is clean is to establish an evaluation type process that you take a site through. You gather data on the hazardous substances that are there. You evaluate the potential for contamination of drinking water supplies. You look at your air and water pollution and maybe hazardous waste control statutes and rules to see if those can provide any guidance. And then you look at the risk posed by that particular site. and make some judgments on what's an acceptable level of risk. And based upon that, what are appropriate type of cleanup actions to achieve that level of risk. It's certainly not something that, at least at the federal level, has been defined very well in a number that's equally applicable to all cases, all substances. It's essentially a case-by-case decision. So the rules could embody a process to establish a process that we take a site through.
Should indicate, by the way, in subsection 2B, underneath there, is that the commission may, as appropriate, take into account in this rulemaking such issues as long-term uncertainties associated with land disposal, persistence, toxicity, mobility, and propensity to bioaccumulate such hazardous substances, short and long-term potential for adverse health effects, long-term maintenance costs, future remedial action costs if the remedial action fails, potential threat to human health, relative to transportation, that is really off-site disposal, and then, of course, cost effectiveness. Those are the types of issues that would be that, again, the Commission may take into account as they are doing the rulemaking. That is language that is very close to what the federal language is also.
Senator Kintai.
I think my questions are pretty well answered, but my concern was that different types of material would be treated differently according to their relative toxicity and so forth.
Very easily could be, and in fact, the criteria under capital C, that is one of the criteria that will be evaluated as persistence, toxicity, mobility, and propensity to bioaccumulate.
Okay.
Section 6 basically is that we may order such cleanup. Effectively, what we've done so far in the bill is gone through the definitions and all that, have said basically that we've got to develop rules, which is the framework in which such cleanups will take place. Now we're starting to move into actually how the cleanups will take place. Section 6 deals with the actual ordering of a cleanup, that we may order such things, again, what all they take into account. And then the key pieces are exactly how that order works. Okay, I want to be sure I get the right sections here. Okay, what I'm wanting is this 6-6. So.
Line 18 of page 10.
Okay, yeah, it'll be here. Yeah. Okay, basically what we're outlining is that that an order shall be able to be issued. Are we clear where we are? Now, the order then will be issued to be able to go ahead and handle the cleanup. And that, except for certain places where I'll get to in a moment in terms of the appealability of that, that order is not going to be appealable either to the commission or subject to judicial review. Now, that's very similar to the federal program. That is, that basically what you do is you go ahead and you order a cleanup, and then you allow parties to come back and be able to seek reimbursement if they have been unnecessarily or unfairly charged with a cleanup that they do not feel liable for. And effectively what it does is it's an encouragement to be able to get responsible parties to be able to take action and not to have all the time spent on litigating those issues all the way up and through. Again, parallel to the federal law, and this is one of those issues that industry, they certainly speak for themselves, but did want as a way to be able to, one, parallel the federal role, and also ensure they had an even relationship with other potential responsible parties. So basically, as I'm marching down then through that section, what it is first off, the order is not appealable or subject to judicial review, that any entity may seek reimbursement, this is subsection 7A, may seek reimbursement. If, in fact, that reimbursement is refused by the director, that then is appealable to the circuit court. That the test for whether or not it is going to be reimbursed is that the preponderance of evidence must be that they're not liable, or that we have taken actions which are arbitrary or capricious, and not in accordance with the law. Now, if we take the cleanup action ourselves, we take the action because we cannot get a responsible party, we may recover costs and, in fact, may recover punitive damages not to exceed 3 times the amount of the actual costs. This is already an existing law from House Bill 2146 from the last session on any kind of spills or releases to the environment. It would be expected to be limitedly used, but it's the encouragement to make sure that responsible parties take the action rather than allowing it to be able to be done. Now, in subsection
6A,
let's see what I want. 8. I want that. Most cost-effective use.
Yeah.
Okay.
Page 11, line 24.
This is the direction to the commission for, or the department for what action or what type of remedial action it shall select. It must be one that is protective of human health and the environment, 2, that's cost-effective, and 3, utilizes permanent solutions and alternative treatment technologies and resource recovery technologies to the maximum extent practical. Make sure that these problems go away completely and yet are, in fact, protective of public health. Okay. Now, strictly liable, section 7. So what we've said is, this is what the department does. They issue the orders. Responsible parties can be able to move ahead under those orders. If they don't, the state can clean up, and they're held liable for those costs up to 3 times, in fact, if there are punitive damage to be assessed. Now, the question is, who is strictly liable? Because that's really whether or not you've got a responsible party out there who must take certain actions. This is addressed in Section 7. Those people who are strictly liable are the owner or operator at the time of the release. Any owner or operator who became the owner or operator after the release and who should have known or reasonably should have known that there was a problem. And, of course, any owner-operator who obtained knowledge but transferred the title to somebody else without disclosing that knowledge. And then, lastly, actually a couple more, but the most important one is anybody who, by acts or omissions, have compounded the problem, and they are then liable to the extent of that compounding. Of course, anybody who unlawfully hinders the cleanup will be also liable. Okay, so those who are strictly liable without regard to fault. Then we end up going on to define who is not liable. Okay, so we've got the ones who are strictly liable without regard to fault. Now the ones who are definitely, who are out of liability, except for some exceptions, are the owner-operator who became the owner-operator and did not know or did not reasonably know. Any owner or operator of a site that basically from a neighboring site the migration of the contaminants have occurred onto their property. Any owner or operator who as a result of acts of God, acts of war, or omissions of third parties has in fact received such contamination. And that third party defense has to be asserted by that third party. You have to assert the fact that it was an act or an omission of a third party that in fact caused something to happen. So those are the people who are not liable. It goes on to be able to indicate that certain other situations are not liable. State or local governments, if in fact they've received the property involuntarily, or they've exercised eminent domain. So if highway takes over by eminent domain piece of property, they are not going to be held liable for it. And any person who acquires property by inheritance or bequest. Okay, then we go on to be able to say, notwithstanding the exclusions from liability. So we try to define those people who are strictly liable and those people who are not liable, and say that those people who are excluded from liability are not if, in fact, they had actual knowledge and didn't take 2 things, didn't fail to promptly notify the department and failed to exercise due care. This is in subsection DuCare. 4A on page 14. So even if you're out of the liability but didn't promptly notify and didn't exercise due care, allowed the situation to get worse, you will still be liable, failed to take reasonable precaution. Now, if anybody attempts to be able to get out of the liability by saying, selling a piece of property and requiring that buyer to hold them harmless and so on, those don't stick. Specifically, rule those out. Okay. Now, all of this still allows private party actions against other private parties. Not mean that those issues of liability, one party against another, will not still be there. It just is they are not exempt from the liability established by this statute. Okay. Now we do at the end of that section, end of section 7, put in a definition of what it means to be, to have reasonably should have known. The language appears, let's see, yeah, subsection 6 on page 15 at the very bottom of the page, line 25. And the key language in there is that they have taken actions consistent with good commercial or customary practices in effort to minimize liability. So if they did that, they will then have exercised that should have reasonably known standard. Now, when we finish the language on liability, what I would like to do is ask Kurt Burkholder to be able to address one issue which we did not specifically address within the language here, and that is the question of joint and several liability. But to be able to address that, we'd like to have an issue read into the record, or at least commented upon for the record, and be able to hand you an item for the written record. And what it'll do is clarify what that legal liability is. Kurt?
I won't read Fred's statement, but in a nutshell, in the Federal Act, the courts have found that liability is joint and several. This is in addition to strict, which means that whether you're negligent is not relevant to your liability. Joint and several means that if you're one of many actors that contributed to the problem, you're liable for 100%. Each one of you are. That's not expressly stated in the federal statute. It's not expressly stated here. Courts on the federal level have referred to common law principles. If the harm is indivisible and not capable of apportionment, that means in reality if you have multiple generators, transporters in the federal scheme, a better example here, various owners or operators over a certain period of time, all of whom put barrels of waste onto the property, which all combined to a nasty soup and you can't tell who contributed what, each one of them will be jointly and severally liable. Now, that is a common law principle. That is how the courts usually apply the test. If you can identify that harm with a particular actor, it's divisible, and they're only liable to that extent. That's not put expressly in the statute so that the courts will have the opportunity to apply the common law test on a case-by-case basis. But I believe it's the purpose of the department to offer the statement into the record so that it's understood. The reason it's not expressly said is so that it could revert to common law test as opposed to not allowing several liability in those instances where the harm is apportionable and identifiable per one defendant.
Okay. Section 8, let me turn to. Basically, it's keeping a record of the costs. A couple of issues that are important there is, one, that it does provide for Good Samaritan protection. That'll be in subsection. Did I get the right?
You're in section 7. Good Samaritan protection.
This is the tail. Oh, okay, pardon me. In tail end of section 7, this is my numbering problem. Subsection 7 is the Good Samaritan protection. It also indicates that in subsection 7B that the emergency response of a state or local government to a spill, there is no liability unless there's gross negligence, reckless, willful kind of conduct. Again, trying to be able to protect those individuals. Okay. Section 8 is keeping costs. All the monies that are recovered, either through punitive damages or costs, go back into the funds. Also provides that the department can collect information to be able to take actions, be able to enter onto property, to be able to get samples and all those sorts of things to be able to carry out its responsibility. It does require, except for the most extraordinary circumstances, that if the property owner wants us to split samples with them, that we will do so. That they will have access to the same information we have. However, and I stress that nothing can be slowing us down in that process, and that's at the tail end of that next section. Confidentiality is protected as it would be under the public records law to that extent. Section 10 is the lien section, identical to what you've done in other.
What section was that?
Section 10. That is exactly identical, right. Is it not? Exactly identical to what you've done in the other bills. Section 11 is that an underground storage tank fee for remedial action can be assessed. That's one of the issues that need to be, that we do not have specific dollars in there for the remedial action piece of it other than oversight, but that fee authority is there in Section 11. Section 12 is the $20 per ton fee at Arlington. Section 13 and 14 are actually the creation of the funds, that the two funds, one for underground storage tank remedial actions, the other one just for hazardous substances. Section 15 creates a civil penalty, $10,000 per day for violations, any provisions of the Act. Section 16 indicates that for anyone who knowingly or willfully violates these, that it's a criminal offense. $10,000 maximum, not more than 1 year or both in prison. Again, that's parallel to the existing hazardous waste statutes in terms of penalties. Section 17 amends the existing statute relative to environmental notice, environmental hazard notice, and basically says any facility that's so defined can also be listed as for environmental notice purposes. What I do is jump ahead to Section 18. Now, we've got people are liable. We've got the ability to be able to have the department order certain actions to be taken, and how they have to be able to pay. What we want to be able to accomplish, and what the federal law provides for, is that agreements may be entered into between the department and responsible parties, or a group of responsible parties, to be able to facilitate a cleanup. And this Section 18 is really what's addressing that agreement. Now, there's nothing that mandates that such an agreement has to be entered into, but that basically some of the key things about it are important. Number one is that if an agreement is reached, it's not appealable to the commission or subject to judicial review. It will have to be entered into the court, by the way, though, as a consent decree. It does provide that parties may be able to be reimbursed if they take on a cleanup. And effectively what it is multiple parties are out there. You end up going to a particular party. They feel that they want to be able to go ahead with the cleanup. They're not as responsible as they're willing to spend money on. We can reimburse them for getting the cleanup going ahead, so that when you have either unfound parties or unwilling parties to participate, we can still have cleanups moving ahead. Now, when we reach such an, cleanup, and we find out that once into it, the additional cleanup needs to be done, work has to be done down the road, the same proportion of splits among the various players that have funded a cleanup will have to, will remain. Again, as I said, and this will be in section 4A, subsection 4A of that section, deals with the fact that this agreement must be entered as a consent decree in the circuit court. Now, again, this is at the very beginning. We've reached an agreement with parties, a party or parties, about a cleanup. Once having to reach that agreement, there are some steps we have to go through, but it gets entered as a consent decree with the court. We must provide public notice. This will be in subsection 4D. Must be able to propose public notice so that anybody can comment on it, other potential responsible parties as well as the public, about the type of agreement that we've reached. And of course, then we shall, in fact, allow for that comment to be evaluated. Once we get into the process, we shall, that negotiation process, we determine there's a problem, needs to be cleaned up. We can enter into negotiations with the various parties. We will give them, once we've identified what those responsible parties are, we'll give them 60 days.